June 3rd, 1991, 1 p.m., Hearing Room 357, House Committee on Judiciary, Subcommittee on Civil Law and Judicial Administration.
Judicial Administration. We're temporarily a little short of members for a work session, but we want to go ahead and I guess until we get the next member, we're going to go into work session on House Bill 3520 at that point in time. Right now, we're going to have a public hearing on House Bill 2732. Most learned staff, why don't you bring us up to speed on 2732?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2732 would limit the liability of charitable organizations by adopting the liability limitation structure which exists in the Oregon Tort Claims Act. We heard this bill a couple of weeks ago for the first time, and there was some considerable discussion regarding insurance rates paid by various charitable organizations, and we asked the proponents of this bill to come back to our subcommittee and discuss some of these provisions, some of these issues.
I think based on our previous discussion with the proponents of the bill, we wanted some specific information about some kind of insurance problem, either inability to get insurance or possibility of extreme high cost for the same, and also specific incidents where they may have had any situation occur that had essentially caused an organization to suffer severe financial distress. Staff needs to go ahead and call or contact Representative Van Leeuwen.
We did.
Well, we appreciate your efficiency. Thank you. So we got to have a whole lot of witnesses to testify on this bill. So we just picked up our quorum, didn't we? Okay, before we go into this public hearing on this, which is going to take a little while, I want to just recess the public hearing on House Bill 2732 and open up a public hearing, a work session, excuse me, on House Bill 3520, and ask Mr. Landau from the Attorney General's office, who has been here for three or four committee meetings, has yet to have an opportunity to put his amendments forward. Why don't you go ahead, Mr. Landau? You want to staff bring us up to speed briefly, and then.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3520 would make several revisions to the way people make tort claims against public bodies. It makes a couple of amendments to the Oregon Tort Claims Act, and also addresses some of the statutes relating to the functions of the Department of Insurance and Finance, the Department of Corrections, and the Psychiatric Security Review Board. In your materials, you should have, at this time, received three different amendments titled DIF Proposed Amendments, which were put forth by the Department of Insurance and Finance, DOJ Proposed Amendments, which were prepared in conjunction with the Department of Corrections and the Department of Justice, and also one entitled the Counties Proposed Amendments, which were proposed by the Association of Oregon Counties.
Mr. Landau.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want you to know that I appreciate the opportunity to actually get to work session on this. I was beginning to think that when my secretary said your bill is up for work session, I could rank that statement with some other time-honored ones like your check is in the mail. I testified at some length on this several weeks ago. Just to refresh your recollection, we do have five separate pieces of work in this bill. The first one changes the current Tort Claims Act to permit lawsuits against agencies only, not the individuals, so that we can protect the individuals from just the hassle of a lawsuit, the consequences of being named as a defendant in a lawsuit. It doesn't change anything substantively in terms of the rights of plaintiffs because those parties are subject to indemnification by the state anyway. So no one is prejudiced. We think that one is very straightforward and in accordance with some common sense. Second one responds to a statute of limitations problem. We're just trying to make sure that the state is subject to the same statutes of ultimate repose that all other defendants in all other suits are subject to. Again, that one we think is pretty straightforward. The third attempts to codify statutorily the majority rule in other jurisdictions with respect to the liability of state governments. That is the public duty rule, and that would clarify that the state is not liable when the state is sued for actions of third parties who are not state officials based on some non-statutory duty to warn or investigate or take others, other type of action. The fourth one we offered to implement what we understand to be the legislature's intent in prior attempts at changing the Tort Claims Act, and that would simply remove the public duty rule from the statute of limitations that applies to actions against the state. And the fifth briefly spells out what we think is implicit in this, the discretionary function exemption of the Tort Claims Act and specifies certain types of decisions are, in fact, discretionary and subject to immunity under the Tort Claims Act. I don't have any additional amendments other than those previously mentioned by committee counsel. If you have any questions at this point, I'd be glad to answer them.
Questions of Mr. Landau? Well, I ask you to sit tight. Any of the members want to decline, but I'll have to testify on this as a work session. We have several amendments before the committee. We have the DIF proposed amendments, the DOJ proposed amendments, and the county's proposed amendments.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Clark.
Those are all in the packets. Shall I?
Well, actually, it's.
You should have received them, two of them,
in
on
the previous
last Thursday's session. And then
I like that as gifts.
Okay, that one you got today. The other two you should have got last Thursday when you put the bill over.
I want to make sure all the members here are up to speed and ready to go or not go, whatever you want to do. I think that there's basically, unless I was mistaken, there was no objection last time in committee to the first page of the bill. Is that correct? There, I think the issue came up on page 3 is where there was some contention. So I would suggest, Representative Edmondson, for the passage of the bill, that we we remove that bracket of language out of page 3, line 37 through 39, the bold-faced language. Do you understand? We just want to make sure to turn the page there, mm-hmm. which eliminates discovery. Mm-hmm. And with that and with those other amendments, I think we've got something hopefully most of the members of the committee can vote for.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Bell.
I had written a comment on my bill, and I think it's because we didn't get a chance to discuss it very much, but that was about the liability to the individual in CSD who makes a decision to leave a child in a home where there has been abuse in the past and they choose to leave them there. Did we talk about that?
No, Ms. Landau, why don't you, did you hear that question? Why don't you explain to him what in practical reality happens if someone in CSD happens to get sued out in Burns, Oregon, they happen to lose, and that for negligent placement or something.
Certainly. Mr. Chair, Representative Bell, if I understand your question right, and correct me if I don't, to the extent that the statutes spell out some duty that a CSD worker has violated, there will be a lawsuit and no immunity. To the extent that liability is based on the action of some third party and there is no duty that's spelled out in the statute, there would be no liability based on the act of that third party. our point is simply that if the legislature feels that the state should be liable for something, you should say so. Spell it out in statute, and the courts can determine whether or not somebody has violated that duty.
Well, let me be a little more specific if I make a hypothetical example. What if in the case where there's been a variety of reports to CSD that this home contained an abuser, and this child was in threat, and a particular CSD worker refused to listen to those, phone calls or public appearances or whatever, just refused to listen to the ones reporting, and went ahead and left the child in a home where then it was abused and maybe killed?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bell, if the CSD worker simply refused to deal with the information at his or her disposal, then off the top of my head, it seems to me we're dealing with somebody who has willfully or wantonly neglected their duty and would not be subject to defense, immunity, or protection of the law in any event. And so this particular legislation would not affect that.
Okay. Representative Edmondson, then Representative Clark.
Just following up on that, if the situation were not that it was intended that the consequence occur, but the worker was just reckless and didn't care and did nothing to do, I mean, that's recklessness, and that is covered under the immunity.
If you're talking, Mr. Representative Edmondson, if you're talking about that kind of gray area, you're going to always find one of these gray areas whenever you make laws, There will be something that falls short of willful, wanton, or reckless, I think is the term that's used in the statute itself. And that would not be covered, and that would not be covered by the statute, and they would still be entitled to indemnification. We had a difficult time trying to figure out in the real world what kind of situations there are going to be that actually fall within that.
Well, as I understood, the Tort Claims Act, the course and scope of employment includes reckless conduct, but does not include intentional conduct. So, which the difference being that in intentional conduct, the person intends the consequence of their actions. In reckless conduct, they just don't care what happens. And some people would say that's even worse for public officers, counselors, and that sort of thing are included.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, I think that's right. And as I suggested, if you can come up with an example where you want to make a state worker liable for failing to act to protect someone, then I think the legislature should say so and make that clear. Otherwise, what we have is this very open-ended guessing game that goes on with respect to the limitless possibilities of liability when the state is supposed to take action that is nowhere spelled out in the statute in order to protect the public against people they don't know, and only with the benefit of hindsight and a good lawyer can you ever make the case that the state should have done anything at all? I think I gave you a number of what we think are some pretty common examples in the securities area where people make investments, they lose money, they sue the people who sold them the money. Of course, they're in the Marshall Islands and beyond the reach of the courts, and so they go after the state and say, "State, you should have warned me. You should have told me not to waste my money on this offshore bank or this scandal." The state cannot possibly be responsible for counseling each and every investor or consumer on each and every investment or consumer decision. That's the kind of thing we're trying to get at.
Representative Clark.
Mr. Landau, on the DOJ amendments that were offered, I guess, last week, having to do with probation, parole, and post-prison supervision decisions, I've got a couple of questions about that. Says no public body and no officer, employee, et cetera, shall be liable for any act or omission relating to probation, parole, post-prison supervision, leave, or work release decisions, or the supervision of persons on probation, parole, post-prison supervision, leave or work release. My first comment is, is that as broad as it seems to me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I have to confess the first time I looked at that language, I asked the same question that seemed awfully broad. The response that I got from the drafters is what I will pass along to you. It seemed to make sense to me. Yes, it is broad, but the kinds of decisions that you're talking about are the very archetype of discretionary decisions. If you take a look at the Court of Appeals decision in, I believe it's the Hendrickson case, it talks about parole-type decisions being the quintessential discretionary function.
Okay. Let me move past decisions for a minute, and let's talk about supervision. That seems to me to be a different issue altogether, where I have a certain amount of sympathy for people who are supervising persons on probation or parole or post-prison supervision, leave or work release. Hey, theirs is a very difficult job. But I wonder, should there be an outright prohibition against liability against the state if one of its agents fails adequately to supervise somebody, for example, on work release, and that person turns around and commits some heinous crime, or even simple supervision of someone on probation or parole, where there was an obvious, what would seem obvious in retrospect, hint that something was wrong, and a probation officer, parole officer, failed to take what would be sort of routine action under the circumstances to revoke somebody's probation or parole. Should there be an outright exemption for the state for its agents who fail to supervise? Decisions are one thing, to parole or, but failure of supervision seems to me to be a different issue. I just wonder if you have any comment on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, I think it's the same problem. It is a decision. It is the decision how much supervision to impose, depending on a whole host of circumstances that can never be anticipated by way of statute. And those are, again, the kinds of decisions that are necessarily involving exercise of discretion. How many times should a person report in? What should you do in response to a person missing an appointment? What should you do in response to a host of different conditions? It always looks, when you are faced with after-the-fact evidence, when
let me take it one step further.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair. We passed a bill, I think Representative Bell was involved in it, perhaps out of the other subcommittee, the one that I chair, that said that when a victim had to do with sex offender registration, and one of the things it said was that when a convicted sex offender moves to a new community, I think it said, I recall, and if
call
it didn't,
in.
Let's assume that
mm-hmm.
it said that the victim would be notified of this movement, of the sex offender, if this sex offender moved back into the victim's community. Now, let's say, and let's assume for just a minute that that's a statutory responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, just to make it clear, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Just to make it clear, the responsibility was on the victim to call in periodically and find out. The responsibility wasn't on the state to notify every movement. The toll-free number would allow them to call in at any time and find out where the offender was.
Okay, well, let's assume that there's wrong information given out then. There's an act, and line 3 of the amendment says any act. Let's assume that there's wrong information given out there, and the offender again commits a crime against the victim, and the victim can prove that if he or she had known, they would have taken some preventative action. Again, my question, should there be outright blanket liability or exemption?
If you have a decision, such as I think the one that you just laid out, Representative Clark, that involves the weighing of a whole host of competing policy objectives, allocation of resources, trying to figure out what to do with your time, your staff's time, how much supervision should we initiate and maintain over a particular person, that's a discretionary decision. That's the kind of thing that ought to be covered by immunity. To the extent that you have a specific statutory mandatory obligation, there's nothing in this legislation, certainly there's nothing that was intended to change the liability of the state when those mandatory obligations are not complied with. And if there's a mandatory reporting requirement, then you should be liable for not acting in accordance with that mandatory duty. What we're talking about are those discretionary decisions that involve weighing of these policy choices that are impossible to second guess in advance.
Representative Bell and Representative Edmondson.
Is there no middle portion to this question? Because as I look at it on one side, if there is complete liability, then you might see, like CSD, taking children out of homes before they really should be taken out of homes. I am not one for, you know, early removal of a child, you know, just on suspicion. On the other hand, if there is complete immunity, we may not force the issue to make them make the decisions as critically as they should. And I see that, to me, this is just offering, you know, this side of the pendulum, and then there's this side. But where's the middle ground? How can we make sure we're protecting the citizenry and also allowing the agencies to work in a productive manner where they make critical, you know, analysis of their decisions?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Bell, I think the middle ground is as I have proposed, and that is to say in the first instance that the state as a rule, and as is the rule in the majority of states now, the state is not liable for failing to warn somebody or take action to prevent some third party from committing a crime or from committing some wrong. If there are exceptions to that, then you need to spell those out.
Lindau, what we're doing here, there is some case law that's described most of the situation. And what we're doing here is with these amendments, which are getting a mixed reception here, I can probably tell you that the page 3, the discovery rule, and you aren't surprised by this at all, is probably gone from the bill. But what we'd like to do is salvage what we can. And the DIF proposed amendment, which you are familiar with, that looks like it has the potential to survive the process. Could you briefly explain that before I... Did I interrupt you? Do you have a question?
I can go back to it. I wanted to answer that question. That was one of my questions. I've got another one.
You wouldn't mind just briefly explaining that for us?
Well, we have Laurie Spillman, who's here, who proposed that amendment. Maybe you want to go directly to her.
We just want to do what we can.
I'd like to also, as you're thinking about this, a quasi-public state agency of Oregon, one of its chief executive officer last week in a legislative hearing suggested that his quasi-public company might be bringing a lawsuit against the Secretary of State for failure to perform its audit functions. And I just want, my question is, would this, if this Section 8 of the proposed bill were law, would that affect any lawsuit by one agency against another?
Well, I don't get any softballs from you, do I?
Well, I mean, I didn't want to say safe out loud.
But it's safe to say that that's what
it's safe
meant.
To say that's what I meant.
Why don't we let Ms. Skillman answer the question and give me a minute to think about how to respond.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Laurie Skillman. I'm the Deputy Administrator for the Division of Finance and Securities in the Department of Insurance and Finance. The proposed amendments labeled the DIF amendments, the Department of Insurance and Finance amendments, are set out so that we're not liable for an act or the state is not liable for an act or omission in the administration of the insurance code. And then our amendment says, or to the purchasers or sellers of any securities or commodities, whether registered or unregistered, for any act or omission in the administration of the securities law, which is Chapter 659, or the commodities transactions, Chapter 645. As I testified before this committee earlier, we are in a position where we register securities offerings and license people who sell securities. We also take a lot of enforcement action against persons and entities who sell unregistered securities, and the people are unlicensed and they're committing securities fraud. We have had a number of lawsuits filed against us by persons who were harmed by others who had committed securities fraud, and they were simply looking for the deep pocket, which is the state of Oregon, because the fraudulent promoters didn't have the money anymore. And the kinds of actions that they brought against us were the kinds of actions where the investors felt that we should have warned them or we should have done something a little bit differently. As I said, our exposure for 19 people working in this little tiny section was up to $117 million just 14 months ago. That's why we proposed these amendments. And the other part of the bill that I think is real important is the part of the bill that takes out the individual liability unless that person is acting outside their course of and scope of employment. That part of that bill, which is that first section of the bill, I think is really important. We had all our people in securities sued by someone, and they were named in the lawsuit. They were acting totally within the course and scope of their employment. They were acting totally within the statutes, and it's a real burden and a hardship on them to be named in these kinds of suits. Of course, if they were doing something that they weren't supposed to be doing, then of course they should be named. But just to name them for those kinds of reasons is really unfair. Thank you.
Mr. Landau, you have a response? Thank you.
I wanted to answer Representative Edmonds' question.
Don't run off. You're not out that easy. Just sit tight.
I'd heard the same thing that you just mentioned, but I have not seen a complaint. I haven't seen any.
Well, the audits of state agencies, and the Secretary of State as well as this assembly conduct audits periodically. And I guess the claim that I heard, or at least being suggested, was that if an auditor failed one year to catch an error in the accounting of an agency and didn't bring it to their attention so they could correct it, that somehow there would be some sort of a claim by the agency against the auditor for failing to somehow negligence, for not catching a mistake that if caught would have been corrected. And I think that's far-fetched and really is a really stretches the notion of auditor liability. And I'd like to know if this was in the law, would it somehow protect our auditors who in good faith conduct their audits from later being blamed for the mistake of the agency they're charged to audit, for God's sakes.
Mr. Chair, Representative Edison, there's nothing in our proposal that would affect that one way or the other.
Well, if we were to say, for example, on line 7 of page 4, any act or omission in the audit of any agency or the administration of the insurance code, that would make it real clear, wouldn't it, that auditors are not going to be independently responsible for the mistakes of the agencies they're auditing?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edison, I don't know if you need to do that. To the extent that somebody is acting in the course and scope of their duties when they're conducting an audit and they make judgment calls.
Well, this deals with the state of Oregon and basically the agencies. Now, I'm not so concerned about the individual auditor being sued as the Secretary of State's office, for example.
What I said would apply to the Secretary of State as well. I mean, to the extent that the agency and its officers are acting within the course and scope, they're entitled to immunity and protection that the Tort Claims Act affords. And so I don't think there's anything to be gained by putting that in. I don't think it would do anything.
Why would we need Section 8 then if they're already a
third parties
insurance code? Is it, I guess you said third parties.
Because the quick answer, Representative Edmondson, is because we defend a lot of suits that involve the insurance commissioner and the securities department people and the others that are mentioned in this bill. We're trying to get at the problem where the problem exists. I'm not aware of any lawsuits against the auditors for failing for negligently auditing.
Okay, then. So do you think there's a defense now under the Tort Claims Act for these suits that are brought against the insurance?
Like I said, without knowing the particular facts, I can say as a general statement that if somebody performs an audit within the course and scope.
I'm not talking about audits.
Oh.
I'm talking about the administration of the insurance code.
That's been
now you're able to go in and plead immunities and win. You just want it made clear in the law so you don't have to even get to the point of having to go in and assert your defense?
Mr. Chair, Representative Edmondson, that's exactly the point. I mean, okay. I've personally defended a couple of these, and they take about 3 years to get to the point at which the judge can make.
I think that in view of the fact that we've got at least one state employee talking about these kinds of suits on audit, the same situation, I'd hate to miss an opportunity to save you some work in the future. So I think I understand. Thank you.
The safe subject to the same tort limitations as the state of Oregon?
Yes.
Yes.
So we have the state still in the state?
Yes.
Oh, great. Any case, let's try to see if we can actually move this bill around a little bit.
Frommeyer versus safe.
Right. Everything is politics in the building. Do we have any objection to the DIF amendments as they've been written?
Well, I just want to, I have the amendment that I'm talking to. I don't have objection to those.
Any objection to the DIF amendments to House Bill 3520? Hearing none, they are so adopted.
I'd like to, Mr. Chair, on page 4, line 7, after the first the, which is any act or omission in the, I'd like to add, or move to add, audit of any agency or the, which just